Do not attempt to change the channel.
All media are extensions of some human faculty.
Is books part of the media?
Media, we don't need it, do we?
Baby, this thing is bigger than all of us.
The media. A lot of you out there probably never even heard of the word.
Media is any form of communication. It can be radio, television, computers.
Welcome to the internet, my friend. How can I help you?
You know, we live in the most mediated society in world history. You spend 10 to 12 hours a day with media. And so I think it makes sense to think about, in a sort of systematic and sustained way, our relationship with media.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Be the Media. This is CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, and on this show, Be the Media, we talk about all things media, from the local to the global, from perspectives of consumers and also of producers. All contributors of Be the Media are faculty, students, and friends of the Media Studies Department and Media Research Lab at Vancouver Island University. I'm Marian Vanderzon, and on this show, we're going to have two live interview segments, the first on the idea of invisibility. Specifically invisibility in media, but that does branch out to many other elements of our lives. And next up, we're going to have an interview segment on a pirate radio station that was running in the Cowichan Valley during this summer. So we have the founder in the studio here, and we're going to chat with her about that project. So we will finish the show off with the sixth installment of Robin Davies' excerpts from An Oral Machine. Let's jump in. A couple of Fridays ago, Dr. Ravindra Moabir presented at VIU's Arts and Humanities Colloquium, and he was presenting on the subject of On Children, Technology, Spiders, and More, the Multidimensionality of Invisibility. Ravindra Moabir teaches in the Media Studies Department and is co-director of the Media Research Lab. He has a doctorate in communication and culture from York University with a dissertation on media life skills for the 21st century. He's an immigrant to Canada and has recently moved here from Toronto for the opportunity to teach at Vancouver Island University. He's also a contributor to this program, and last week it was, he had his first segment, his first pre-produced segment on the show, and I thought it would be a lot of fun to bring him in live and have him talk about the ideas of invisibility. Ravi, welcome.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you here, Ravi, and I think we should just jump in. So our listeners know that we're going to be talking about invisibility, and when you write and you speak about the idea of invisibility, you talk about invisibility as though it works as a process. What do you mean by this?
Well, as a process, most people think about the outcome. Most people think about invisibility as invisible things, things you can't see. But I don't really think about it just as a question of seeing. You have to go well beyond the notion of seeing and really start to think about it in a broader dynamic. There's lots of things that are invisible to us that we can see. There are lots of people who we walk past on the street, and for the want of not having enough time to pay attention to all of them, or even the things that are surrounding them, we block them out. We don't pay attention. And that not paying attention doesn't make them invisible in the sense that we can't see them. We can see them. We just don't necessarily want to or need to. And sometimes they get in the way. So we just kind of move through our life in a process of mystifying and demystifying the world. And visibility is often thought of as demystifying, but often visibility is making things very simple for ourselves so that we can define them.
So in essence, a coping mechanism.
Well, sometimes. I mean, you could say that visibility is a coping mechanism. Without visibility, there wouldn't be fixed boundaries on things, so things would be very complicated. We wouldn't really necessarily be able to stop and say, well, what is that and what is it connected to in order to get quickly from place to place.
Right. Well, it ties into our love of classification. You know, this is certainly something that we engage in all the time as humans.
Absolutely. Classification is a necessary element to human life. We decide what things are important, what things aren't. And deciding what's important and what's not important is really a process of invisibility. The things that we determine to be really, really unusual, really special, then we position them in a position of authority. We give them a certain amount of preference over other things. That doesn't mean that they're better or worse. We just pass judgments. And to a certain extent, we have to pass judgments.
Okay, so that is interesting. If we're passing judgment on the things that are coming through our lives, when you're theorizing about this, is that this something that is learned, or is it intuitive? Is it genetic?
It's both, actually. I'm not really quite at the stage where I'm sure about the genetic nature of it or the naturalness of it, but I know that it's something that we have to do because the world is too complicated. There's too many things going on all the time. So those things that are ordinary, we render to be invisible in the sense that we don't pay attention to them. Because if we had to pay attention to all of the ordinary things, the things that are extraordinary or get put in front of us that we don't fully know what to do with, those things, they sort of get to be too difficult to negotiate. So what we do is if we pass through the world, I mean, think about it in this way as an example. If you go home and your partner's changed something small about themselves, they change their hair, they're put on a different kind of clothing, we don't usually notice right away, and we're usually embarrassed when somebody says to them when they walk up to them on the street, "Well, your hair looks nice." And they said, "Well, finally, somebody noticed." Well, the reason we don't notice is because we don't need to notice. We notice those things as ordinary. We don't spend as much time thinking about them or going into depth about them. But the things that are extraordinary, things that are unusual, that are out of the way, what we have to do, and probably this is a natural instinct, is we have to deal with the unusual and we have to make sense of it within the framework of what we already know.
Okay, so why is the invisible important? Well, I understand it is important, sure, from what you're suggesting.
Well, the invisible is important on a number of different levels. The first I would say is the invisible is important because it's around us all the time. It's everywhere. It's a part of everything we know. I would say that invisibility is the context or the background about from which we come to understand everything. So there are things around us all the time, and from those things around us, we carve out little niches. Those things become visible. Those things become ordinary. Those things become how we think about the world. And until and unless we make sense of the context, then those things become sort of depoliticized, really simple. So, for instance, there are words in our language that we use that we don't necessarily question the points of origin or what they mean. But at the end of the day, when we use words over and over and over again without thinking about the context from which they emerged, then those words just sort of become neutral and dulled down. And we know, as academics, we know that words are never neutral. Many words come from very political positions. There are, in the history of the world, lots of words that come from certain positions about ethnicity, certain positions about gender, certain positions about age and class, and all of those things. And without context, just using the words over and over and over again, we just start to replicate that. And in reproducing it, we come to think of them as common sense, just ordinary ways of thinking about it. Invisibility is important because it leads us to that background, questioning the back end, mm-hmm, questioning the things that we don't usually pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a tangible example? You're talking about words. Maybe there's
sure. Well, in women's health, there's a procedure called a hysterectomy. Many people will know about that procedure. And a hysterectomy, the word hysterectomy comes from what Michel Foucault, who is a French philosopher, described in The Birth of the Clinic. He described the word hysterectomy coming out of the long-standing belief that as women entered menopause, they became hysterical. Hysterical in the sense that they couldn't control themselves and there were things going wrong. Hot flashes were a sign of senility or some other madness. So that hysteria was calmed by a hysterectomy. A hysterectomy coming directly from the idea that women were losing control of themselves as they naturally aged, which is a really unusual thing to think about because we use the word neutrally. It doesn't seem like anything. It's a procedure. And if it comes from medicine, it just has to be a real thing and it has to have no political bent to it. It's science, and science is normal and science is natural. Well, science isn't natural or normal. It's just as political as anything else. Mm-hmm. So that's one example of it. There are other examples that come up as well. Recently, actually, in the news, and I've been listening to lots of reports about this, and I'm sure many, many others have as well, there's this notion of transparency that comes about, particularly when talking about governments. Right now, the big thing in the news is, as you know, WikiLeaks. And everybody's talking about and debating the value of WikiLeaks. What is the value of transparency? What is the necessity of transparency from governments, from other organizations? Who has the right to decide what should be and should not be transparent or opaque? And I think that notion is a really interesting notion because it plays with the idea that we need to know everything. But on some levels, we want to know everything, but we don't really want to know it. Because if we did, then we'd have to deal with everything that we did know. So that notion of transparency is, well, how much do we feel we have the right to know? And how much do we feel that we want to know? And a lot of people engage in a practice of what you would call willful ignorance. They may know that the government does something good or bad or otherwise, but they're willing to ignore it because they're just willing to live with certain things. And I think that's a difficult road for people to travel, because on the one hand, we want to know, but on the other hand, what do we do when we do know? So invisibility on some levels is a sense of ignorance that we provide for ourselves to just be able to negotiate the world.
Well, this willful ignorance that you speak about, I guess in some ways it makes life a lot easier. You don't have to delve into things in the full context and their full complexity.
Well, absolutely. The more willfully we are ignorant, the more likely it is that we're doing this as a management or a coping mechanism. And I don't mean that in a negative sense or even in a pejorative sense. Everybody needs coping mechanisms just to negotiate the world. A while ago, I was listening to the CBC and there was a Massey lecture from the 80s. By someone named R.D. Lang, who is a psychiatrist, and he was speaking about a variety of different things to do with the origins of family counseling and family therapy and making sense of where we come from and who we are. And in it, he quoted Nietzsche, and Nietzsche said that the truth that we have that we use to negotiate the world is really just a series of lies that we don't think about as lies. We ignore the fact that none of the things that we use to walk through the world are really actually facts. They're just things. They're just ideas that we come up with. And the whole notion of the truth being a socially constructed thing, something that we make up just to help us pass ourselves through the world, it's a difficult thing for us to deal with, because that would, as he suggests, quoting Nietzsche, that would make us go crazy if we had to think about everything every time and question everything every day all the time. And to a certain extent, no matter how critically we live our lives, we do have to just accept certain things, and whether we accept them because they're right or wrong, we accept them because we come to pass belief over them as being good enough.
Okay, so we accept them because they are good enough to accept, and that's how we are able to continue to function in our world.
Absolutely.
Let's bring this back to media.
Okay.
And so how do these ideas then, how would you apply them to media?
Well, media is an interesting case because media has a variety of different points of entry for this notion of invisibility. One of the things that I'm working on right now is the notion of the invisibility of technology. And what I say in that regard is that technology becomes increasingly invisible. And in a highly technologized world, it's hard to see how that's possible. There's technology everywhere. People have it with them. They carry their phones around with them. They have laptops over desktops because they want to keep their computer as close as possible. They want it to be mobile. They want it to work wherever they are. Now, the trick is that you don't really see the desktop computer. You don't really see the television set. What you see is the content. And a lot of people are looking at the content much more so than the point of delivery. So what I'm suggesting is that technology is becoming more invisible. So to a certain extent, you can see this played out in the changing fortunes in the technology world. So Apple right now is on a big high and they're moving up, whereas a lot of other companies who are concentrating more on hardware, they're not necessarily going very far because there was a disconnect in let's say, PC computing between the people who made the content interface devices, so Microsoft, and people who made hardware. Apple took control of the whole endeavor. They made the software, they made the hardware, and other people added on afterwards. What they discovered was that despite the fact that their fortunes were made through hardware, what people want is content. And what people want is to be able to get their photos when they want. They want to be able to plug in their computer and be able to hear the music, listen to their favorite songs, to be able to produce video, to watch video, that sort of thing. And they just want it to work. Apple makes money on hardware. They don't make money on software, but they sell computers because of the software. They sell computers because of the experience of content. So people are wanting the content, and the hardware becomes invisible after the first point of purchase. And it's usually not until something breaks or something new comes along and somebody says, well, what you had already isn't quite good enough anymore, that you're being asked to look at your hardware anymore. So invisibility is really important there.
So how does this change if we're looking at, because there is a difference. Also, you know, when Marshall McLuhan was looking at these ideas, he was applying them to radio, television. So we would have a new technology coming in and really taking over for a number of decades before the next one would come in. But still, a lot of people were focused on content. So what is the difference there?
Well, in McLuhan's day, McLuhan talked about the medium as the message. And on some levels, it certainly is true. And you could see this partly demonstrated by what's called Moore's Law. Moore was an executive at Intel who said that every X number of years, the processing speeds would double. And as you can see, as that increases over time, exponentially, that makes it incredibly fast. So it went from, very limited computing power to remarkable computing power in a very short period of time. Now, when television came about, television lasted as a very dominant medium for a fair chunk of time, about 50 years. Radio, you know, give or take, you could say lasted for a fair chunk of time as well. But everything that came after television, as McLuhan suggested, had television as its content. So computing has television as its content, plus radio, plus oral societies, plus reading, plus all of those things. But what was really important in McLuhan's day was that each of those media, the various medium of communication, what they did was they fundamentally altered the space in which they existed. So a television really reoriented the home, built on the way that radios reoriented the home. You had this box that sat in your house, and the box was initially just sort of there. But then the box became the centerpiece of your living room. You changed your living room furniture, the television the same way. You changed the orientation of your home. You changed how conversations occurred. You changed how things were delivered. Now, every new medium that's come since has started to add to that sort of co-location of the physical object of the delivery and the home or the life in which it was, in which it lives. But now, because there are so many different new forms of media and so many different people who are looking at their own device, whatever it is that they choose, whether it's a BlackBerry, whether it's a portable DVD player, whether it's something completely different, everybody's looking at that as, this is my primary device, this is a thing that I want. And the way that they've been sold are not as revolutionary and unusual. They're being sold as things you can't live without. And when you're sold as something you can't live without, it's the same as being sold the idea that the ground is firm and you can stand on it. If you can't live without it, that means you don't have to think about it. It just becomes integrated into your life. And the more deeply it becomes integrated, the more ordinary it becomes. And as it becomes ordinary, it becomes invisible. You can't see it and you don't think about it until there's a problem with it. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely that.
Is it important for us to see the invisible?
Well, yeah, absolutely. It certainly is important for us to see the invisible on a number of levels, not the least of which is that seeing is only one part of that question of invisibility. Usually we think about invisibility as the flip side of seeing, as the flip side of visibility. But there's three other dimensions that are there that I think are important to consider. Invisibility is something that you can hide yourself and not be seen, but you can be heard. And being
similar
heard,
to what you're experiencing right here,
absolutely,
now in the studio.
Absolutely. Being heard is a very important element, because being heard isn't necessarily just about somebody hearing your voice, but also somebody taking to heart what it is that you're saying. Then there's another dimension of power or agency. Power and agency are really sort of co-located in the sense that if you have power, you may be able to control whether people can see you and how they can see you, or whether people can hear you and what they hear from you, and whether or not people believe you, that sense of authoritativeness. And agency is the ability to control that, having the ability to independently navigate that. And this often gets played out on the level of emotion or affect. And the level of emotion, or the playing field of emotion, is whether or not I feel that whatever I'm seeing, hearing, and experiencing in one way or another makes a difference to me. And there's lots of adages in the news game, for instance, that suggest that one dead local person is worth 1,000 dead people from a distant place. Largely because the further away people are, it's not that it's not important, but it doesn't really make me feel all that concerned or compelled. Mm-hmm. The more local somebody is, the more I feel connected to that, then the more powerful it becomes. So we definitely need to see the invisible, but not in a sense of just visually see it. We need to hear and understand and really interact with or feel connected with each other. And invisibility is one of those ways that we can start to question why we do feel that about some people and not about others.
Right. So then how can we go about this?
Well, I think that's a tricky thing. I mean, invisibility isn't one of those things that we can eliminate. And in fact, we shouldn't eliminate. On the one hand, we can't eliminate it because it's everywhere all the time, and it's the context. Eliminating the context really changes the entire game. And I think invisibility is one of those foundational elements of life. It's just one of those things that is a necessary component of living.
Well, you even referenced that it occurs in the natural world as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. In the natural world, invisibility is an act of both protection as well as predation. Animals use camouflage to be invisible. Sometimes it's to protect themselves from the harm from others, and other times it's to lay in wait and make other animals feel comfortable
and
so they can eat.
And that can be said of humans as well.
Absolutely. We do the same thing, in a very direct sense. We could do that. You can see that in hunting behavior. But in other senses, We do that. You can see that in the PR industry. The PR industry does it all the time. What you do is you try to blend in. In the 1930s, Edward Bernays came out with the idea that if I tried to sell you something and I told you that it was a good idea and it's my idea, it's not going to work. But if I sort of blend in and I let you believe it's your idea, of course your idea is great. So you're going to believe your idea much more than mine. So why not work on the idea of just sort of blending in? And if I fit in the background, if I'm invisible, if I can't be seen, then it works great.
And boy, was he right.
Oh, he was absolutely right.
Okay, so back to the, because I don't feel like we've got a tangible
sure.
answer yet. So how, I mean, understanding that we can't see the invisible all the time and using the word see in a very loose
sure.
way, and nor would we want to, but it's important to tap into it occasionally. What are ways in which we can do this? How can we do this?
Well, some of the things that we can question when we're thinking about the notion of invisibility, let's say we're reading the newspaper or we're, let's say we're on Facebook. If you're on Facebook, for instance, and you're engaged in these deep conversations about who's there, who's not there, what's going on, and you're posting your life, thinking about the invisible is
you
a really fascinating thing. Sorry?
You said deep conversations on Facebook.
Well, no, well, the, you friends, your friends are on Facebook are not my friends on Facebook. Apparently. Well, anyway, let's assume that we're having shallow conversations on Facebook.
Shallow, deep, whatever.
As you're having these conversations, you have this whole notion that there are people out there who are interested in listening. And to a certain extent, what you do is you engage with these people as though they're real. And what you're really doing is imagining them in a particular manner. And as you imagine them, these invisible friends of yours, what you're doing is you're constructing them in a way that is either helpful to you or in some way is a way of passing judgment upon you. Sometimes we don't say things because we don't want other people to know. And sometimes we do say things because we think other people will be helpful to us. So when we think about the notion of invisibility there, what we're doing is thinking about in a very purposeful way, why is it that I'm doing what it is that I'm doing? In the 1970s, Walter Ong, who was a student of McLuhan's, he came up with this notion of the imaginary audience. And his idea was that the writer's audience is always fiction. The writer's audience is always fiction says that no matter what happens, when I sit down to write, whether it's a letter to somebody I know or whether it's a book for publication, what I'm doing is imagining somebody sitting in their living room and reading this note, reading this thing. And, you know, you might not be a writer. You might not be somebody who thinks of yourself in that way. But everybody speaks. Everybody communicates in one way or another. And thinking about the person on the other end or someone on the receiving end is an act of invisibility. You're both imagining people, but you're also envisioning what will become of whatever it is that you're saying and how it is that you're going to be interacting with them. So there's that. The other idea of invisibility, how do we put this into practice? Well, if you think about the notion of conscious choices or critical interaction with the world, people often tend to think about the manifest things that we look at, the things that we interact with. So I have this conversation with my kids once in a while. I have we have a very sort of, you know, my kids are 9 and 6. So we have this discussion every now and then when it's that last minute sort of, well, we haven't made anything for dinner. What would you like? And so my son's default position is, well, you know, once in a while I'd like some McDonald's, but I know it's not a good idea. And, you know, once in a month here or there, that's not so bad. But we have this discussion about happy meals or no happy meals. And it sounds really silly and innocuous. But in having that discussion about happy meals or no happy meals, we have the conversation about disposable toys. And we think about the notion of context, and we look at that idea of context as an important consideration. Because that couple minutes of pleasure, maybe even an hour or a day of pleasure that you get from that disposable toy, really does facilitate a very large dynamic process of production, consumption, distribution, energy waste, all of these different things. And when we look at the world in those terms, when we look at the world as being both a manifest thing, something that we do, and a background or at least a location or a context for it, it's important to consider that notion of context. One of the things that I find greatly lacking, and having two kids who are school age now, I recognize that there are reasons for this. But one of the things that I find greatly lacking in society is that notion of context. We don't really talk about context as much as we talk about text. We talk about things. We don't talk about where they come from, where they're situated. And I found it really quite amazing listening to my daughter explain to me that she's reading a story about Christopher Columbus, but from the perspective of a fictional perspective of an indigenous person in the United States when Columbus landed in the United States from the perspective of having people come over, bringing disease, bringing all these other things. I never had that when I was a kid. And she didn't necessarily know how to make sense of it, but she did recognize that there was another story at play there. And that notion of context is something that comes in once in a while, but not as purposefully as it could. And that's something we could talk about with our children, with our friends, all of those kinds of things. Because often people get caught up in the thing that they see, and not necessarily the background of it. Mm-hmm. And you asked before about the notion of invisibility in the media. One of the things that I think will be a good location of making sense of the idea in the media, it probably wouldn't make as much sense on the surface, but when you think closer about it, it does. The idea of celebrity, particularly celebrity in the newfound sense, micro-celebrities and celebrities who are really sort of quick and fading celebrities, the ones who come up and just disappear quite quickly. What you find is that as celebrity comes to the focus or celebrity comes to the foreground, people who are in a position of temporary celebrity really do become invisible. The more that you see their face, the more that you see their biography someplace, the less likely it is that they have any control over what that looks like, they have any voice in making it whatever they want it to be, and whatever feeling is elicited by that, so whether it's you are reviled for whatever it is that you did, or you are applauded for whatever it is that you did, it's hard to live that down. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of people who end up in that position. If you look at somebody like, let's say, Miley Cyrus right now, Miley Cyrus is an interesting position. She's part of a newer generation of child actors or child stars. And as a child star, she was made out to be this remarkable branding machine. So she had her name on everything. She was Hannah Montana everywhere. And you can find Hannah Montana licensed merchandise on everything. But what she had to do when she became 16, 17 years old was she had to really do something remarkable, which was to break character. And in breaking character, she could then start to think about, well, who really am I? And how do I start to paint that picture for myself? Because up till now, I've had a very controlled vision of me presented to the world. Mm-hmm. And I'm limited by that vision. How people see me really does impact how they hear me and what sort of power I have to make choices about what goes on in the world around me. And the more famous you are, until you get to a point, and you might suggest that for some stars, there is a point at which that folds over on itself and they become famous enough and they have enough clout, enough power, that sort of thing, that they can start to speak out. You see this in the case of people like Bono or perhaps like Johnny Depp or Julia Roberts or Brad Pitt. They've become famous enough that they can start to take control and they don't have to worry about getting their next job. They can get their next job. But if you're Miley Cyrus, if you're Flava Flav, if you're any of those guys, any of those kinds of people, whatever it is that made you famous, if you step too far outside of that, you run the risk of going down in flames. So they have very limited control, and the more visible they are, the less control they have, mm-hmm. until they get to a point where they become wealthy enough or are able to move on.
It's interesting, given our propensity in today's culture that so many people want to become famous for the sake of fame, but I think inherent in that is the idea that they're going to gain power through that position. And what you're outlining for us today is that it's potentially exactly the reverse.
Well, absolutely. And I don't think that in this case we could equate wealth and power as necessarily being the same thing. Mm-hmm. Because there is a certain degree of power attached to wealth. But the wealth that you have is not necessarily the same as the agency, which is independent control over what you're doing. In order to maintain that wealth, you have to walk a very tight line. And until and unless you make sense of that, you really can't go beyond it. I had a student a few years ago who was explaining to me the variety. We went through a history of hip-hop together through a course on popular culture. And one of the things that he explained to me was that Flava Flav, who is of Public Enemy fame, and who's got a very bizarre, larger-than-life persona, and many of you may have seen him as fairly recently in one of those Where Are They Now kind of celebrity reality shows. He has training as a classical musician, and he plays 8 or 9 different instruments. He's a gifted and talented musician. He has really good, impeccable musical background, but he's a buffoon and a clown, and he can't be anything else, and he couldn't get work when he tried to be anything else. He could never walk into the New York Symphony and play the piano, even though he may or may not be able to, just because he is who he is. And he is who he is not because that's who he is as a person, but because his wealth and his fame really did limit his ability to make independent choices.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. Ravi, thank you. It's a conversation that I know we could continue for a number of hours. It gives a whole new thought to every element of our lives in the media and beyond. Thank you for coming in and sharing with us. Is there anything else that you'd like to close with before we finish the interview?
Well, I think I'd like to go back to that WikiLeaks idea. When you're thinking about what goes on right now, and when you're trying to make your informed choice about all of this information you're hearing, there's a lot of questions going on around right now about what happens behind closed doors. And to the extent that you think about invisibility after now, what I'd like you to consider is that everything happens at a certain point behind closed doors. And you don't necessarily know what goes on in people's minds as you're walking down the street. You don't know what preoccupies people, and that those little bits of invisibility really do inform how they interact with you. And to a certain extent, what you have to do is really recognize that there's a point at which you can ask, and sometimes people can tell you and sometimes they can't. It doesn't mean necessarily that people are hiding something, but it could be. And what you can keep in mind about invisibility is that it's a very complex thing that it's very difficult to make sense of individually or for somebody else, but it certainly is worth a shot.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
It's been a pleasure. This is Ravindra Mohabir on Be the Media, and you are listening to CHLY 101.7 FM. And I'd like to come out with a track by Bent, Invisible Pedestrian, and many thanks to Stain for finding this one in the vaults. Welcome back. Welcome back to Be the Media. You are listening to CHLY 101.7 FM here in rainy Nanaimo. Next up, we have another fascinating and, in many ways, invisible guest. She's here anonymously at this moment in time. We'll see if it stays that way. I'd like to welcome here CJ, your DJ, from Res Pirate Radio 100.1 FM. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you here, CJ, your DJ. And maybe let's just start by what is Res Pirate Radio 100.1 FM?
All right. Res Pirate Radio is something that I started in the Cowichan Valley over the summer. It was my summer project. And I received my broadcasting unit, which was a 12-watt radio station from a friend of mine. And I was able to run a station for 8 hours a day, twice a week. And it was much like how I started in radio, which was on Gabriel Island for the National Campus Radio Association conference they had there last June. And I was supposed to do 4 hours a day, and I ended up doing about 10 because I was having so much fun. It was my vacation, and that's what it ended up being over the summer.
Radio is a blast, isn't it?
It is.
It is fun.
I was in control.
Indeed. So the experience on Gabriola, that certainly led to the station that you set up yourself. So what was the motivation? What were you wanting to do with that?
Being a native, and I could understand and relate to everything that Ravi was talking about invisibility. I've been invisible my whole life, and this was just another extension of that. I wanted to bring the conversation between natives and non-natives out into the open and find a way for natives to be seen out there in the world. There is a subculture within the society that we live in, because we are an oral tradition society living within a literate society, which is in transition itself. And there's no conversation between the two. There are barriers. There are barriers of agency. There's barriers that are personal as well as public barriers. So I wanted to try to break down those barriers and get the two talking to each other and seeing we are just human. We are just, right. You know, regular people.
So you were doing this in the Cowichan Valley. So where was your listening audience? Who were you hitting?
Well, because it was a near-casting unit, I could only reach the Cowichan Valley. I was able to go out and check one day while the unit was running and found that I could go as far as one end of town to the other, all the way out to Whippletree. And
so you're speaking about Duncan?
Yes, Duncan. So And I wasn't able to get all the way down to Cowichan Bay, but pretty close. So it was a powerful unit, and we weren't in that great of a spot. If I had found a more open spot with where I could put the antenna higher, I could have reached a lot more people. I was really amazed at the reach.
Even though the antenna wasn't in a good location.
Yeah, we had it stuck to an old satellite dish that wasn't being used anymore.
Perfect use for a satellite dish, really.
Yes.
So, okay, so your goal in part then was to connect the community, the native community and the non-native community in the Cowichan Valley, or start to make some connections across. In what ways were you trying to do this?
Well, in speaking with the native community before that, I discovered that the things that they wanted to hear on the radio were things like what was going on with the elders? What were their concerns? Because a lot of the Native community now is working two jobs or going to school and then coming home and spending time with their children, so they didn't have a lot of time to go anywhere and be with the elders as they have in the past. They would go, when you go to speak to an elder, you have to go and be there for 2 to 4 hours minimum. Otherwise, you're being very rude. And,
right.
And nobody has time to do that anymore. So what I would do is I would go to the luncheons that the elders have and, you know, pay my $5 for my lunch and sit and talk with them. And I did that throughout the summer and was trying to get a sense of what it was they wanted to tell the younger people. And I know that the younger people wanted to hear whatever they had to say. They just didn't have the time to do it. So I've heard that over and over again.
Right. So you would take the interviews then, and you would take them yourself and edit them and then air them over the station.
I tried to edit them. And a lot of the times I didn't actually get an interview. I would just get a sense of what they had to say, because of the elders. I discovered you have to spend time with them. And over the summer, they got to know me and trust me, because I've been out of the community for 20 years, and so they didn't know who I was. They knew my family, they knew my parents, and when I went to the luncheon, that was the only way they would talk to me, is I said my name, where I was from, who my parents were, and I got this blank look. And then as soon as I said who my grandparents were, they were like, the whole room just went, oh.
Interesting.
And then they started talking to me.
Right, right. So what I'm hearing from you is that it was a much... It's a long-term project because
it's
a lot about building trust and relationships over time.
That part of it. But what I was able to do was bring First Nations music from all over Canada and the United States, and I put that on air and shared that with everybody. And you didn't have to be Native to listen because it's on the radio waves. Mm-hmm. Anybody can listen. So people who are non-Native could find out just what kind of great music is out there that the Natives are creating.
Yeah.
And it's an invisible world because they don't have the record labels, you know, banging down their door to get that stuff.
Right. So, again, it's important. These artists are falling through the cracks in a lot of instances, so it's good to have the platforms to have their music be broadcast or narrowcast, as the case may be.
Yes.
What was the response from the community, Native and non-Native?
The elders were excited. They really loved the whole idea of being able to find a venue where they could be heard or be seen and share that information. I think the Natives are ready to take that protectionist attitude that they've had all these years and get rid of it and say, you know, we just want to be a part of the rest of society. Now, we don't. There are, you know, reasons and places where they have to be protectionist in the political arena and educational and all that kind of stuff. And that's all great and lovely. But with entertainment, music, and just being able to hear interviews with our elders, those things I think we're ready to share with people.
Great. So generally the response was really positive.
Yes. I was able to influence quite a few young people who heard about it and wanted to get involved. And I think for next summer I'll have a lot of volunteers.
Fabulous. So this is a summer project. It ran for a month and a half, 2 months?
Yeah, about that.
Okay.
About that.
And so it sounds like you're planning to start it up again next summer.
Well, it's going to go with or without me.
Excellent. This is positive news.
Yes, yes. It's got a life of its own. I can't stop it. And I was really interested to hear what you were saying, Ravi, about celebrity and, you know, branding and stuff, because that's what I've been doing with CJ or DJ. I have my own online site now, and people are contacting me from all over the place to try and find out what it is that I'm standing for. And, you know, I really have had to focus on what that is over this last few months since the radio ended, and just going through the classes and discovering about agency and personal agency and barriers and personal barriers. I've discovered that First Nations do have a lot of barriers that they create themselves about not being able to do stuff. You know, we're told from the very beginning of our life, we can't do this, we can't do that. And we start to believe it. And we have to stop believing that there are barriers.
And just do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, fabulous. I'm glad that you did it anyway. So you mentioned now that you've been bringing it into digital media since the project finished for the summer, and you've been doing that, of course, online. So this leads me to question, why pirate radio?
Why pirate radio? Because I tried getting on to the regular radio, to be honest, and I found that they had their own system. I started in February of last year to look for a summer job, and by February of last year, all the jobs were taken, or they weren't even being offered, because there just isn't the support there in that system. But with pirate radio, I didn't need anybody's support. I could just go out and do it myself, and I could create the content. I could get the interviews. I could find the audience. The audience was already there. They're ready. They were ready to hear whatever came out of that unit, because I was focusing on Aboriginal issues that aren't being heard in other places, they are being heard in places like this. It's an hour or it's half an hour, and it's all fluff stuff. You know, in my eyes, which is fine. You know, it's okay to have fluff, but you also need to be able to cover those issues that are very serious. I did get a great interview on reconciliation from one of the elders, and she shared, you know, the story with me, and it took an hour and a half, but it was life-changing. Not just for me, but I've heard from my listeners
from
as
your
well.
Listeners, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, fabulous. Yeah, there is an incredible freedom that comes with pirate radio, of course, because you can use it however you wish, and the options are unlimited. CJ, your DJ, thank you so much for coming in. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Just if you want to find out more, you can send me an email to cjyourdj@shaw.ca. And, hey, I'll listen.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for being here. It's a pleasure to have another active pirate radio practitioner on the airwaves. Folks out there, there is a new book, a fairly new book out there on pirate radio in Canada. I'm one of the co-editors of it. The book's called Islands of Resistance, Pirate Radio in Canada. It's an anthology, so the book brings in individuals, groups of people's stories using pirate radio from coast to coast in Canada, and there are all kinds of stories. And so, CJ, your DJ, I'm happy to have you on air so we can add yet one more story to the plethora of pirate radio that exists out there.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. So let's move out with a track. This next track, CJ, your DJ, selected it herself.
Yes, it's from Kurt Young. It's called Bannock, and it's one of the examples of related music that or something that Aboriginals can relate to, as well as everybody else.
I know it's not right. Are you looking for a fight? I didn't make it home last night. My wrongs don't make you right. Time just got away. My car keys left the very same way. Honey, don't you see? It's always been you and me. When I walked in the door, another bandit hits the floor. And I ducked. Did I say something wrong? I wasn't gone all that long. Always that same old song. Can't we just get along? Your brother's got my car. There ain't much gas, so we can't get far. Betty's passed out in the bar. Getting some R&R. When I walked in the door, another bandit hits the floor, babe. The immune's that same old fight. Daytime mega making up each night. How can some so wicked feel so right? When the bandit hits the floor, she was more.
Hello, folks. You're listening to Be the Media on CHLY 101.7 FM here in Nanaimo. Again, CHLY 101.7 FM. We'd love to hear from you. You can connect with us via email at bethemedia@viu.ca. Again, that's bethemedia@viu.ca. We welcome your calls as well. You can catch us here on air during the show at 250-740-1017. I'd like to move now into the next installment from further excerpts from The Oral Machine. This comes to us from Robin Davies, and it is part 6.
You are listening to Be the Media on CHLY 101.7 FM.
We are pleased to present further excerpts from The Oral Machine.
We are getting around to the idea of noticing that we have a total environment which is necessarily acoustic.
Thank you. Is this radio? Is this an auditory blog? Is this sound art masquerading as academic discourse? You are listening to further excerpts from the Oral Machine. Oral, the new machine that everyone wants, collapses time and space, you see, so the ear can now be coupled with sound waves from the other side of the world, from the past, and perhaps the future. Part 6. One issue which has not really been discussed here has to do with the legalities of sampling. In writing, particularly in academic circles, it is considered perfectly okay to incorporate pieces of work produced by other people into your own, new, work. Citations are clearly presented, and new knowledge is created. In the artistic world, and particularly the electronic music world, massive amounts of sampling happen without the sampled artist even knowing, let alone being credited or compensated for, the sounds which have been appropriated. This is the nature of the oral machine. You never know quite what you are going to get when you activate the device. The oral machine hears everything, and is ruthless in its autonomous reproduction. Last time, we discussed the dirty sample, and the lengths to which practitioners will go to modify their source material into something which bears little resemblance to the source. We also discussed producers who would like you to believe portions of their work are ancient, and bear the auditory marks of time. Distortion, and other digital and pseudo-analog artifacts, are merged with source material to create the lived-in look, or should I say, the lived-in sound. A favorite technique of mine for manipulating found sounds requires a digital razor blade, or perhaps a Freddy Krueger glove which can cut the source into small bits. What if we took our source material, our original sample, and shortened it a little? I have an illustration taped to the wall above my computer, a sketch by Danielle Sim, which depicts a businesslike but rather scary man hacking up various audio media with a meat cleaver. I do this too, virtually, and the activity is usually the first step in my creative process. Take your source material, split it into bits, and then let it digest and reassemble itself, like a creature from Resident Evil. Pardon the horror movie references. That was part of a tune called Gave Up, specifically a remix by Coil and Hyde. Like Trent Reznor, I enjoy performing surgery on the human voice. By using the human voice in this manner, the producer can achieve creative and compositional benefits beyond those of digestion and collage. Even when diced and spliced, the snippets of human voice retain the essential human quality. Regardless of what language the listener speaks, she will inevitably try to make sense out of the fragments and syllables. The listener hears a fellow human in there, and the brain strains to understand the message. The amalgamation of these kinds of fragments of ideas, quickly displayed images, and portions of sentences, all have the same kind of effect in other forms of media as well. Consider the rapid pace of editing in music videos, the tag clouds generated by popular blogging software, or the kind of brainwashing images seen in Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange. I am by no means the first to employ this kind of cut-up technique in music. One of the godfathers of computer and electronic music, Paul Lansky, has created many pieces using the human voice in this way, starting with one called Idle Chatter. Lansky writes about a subsequent piece of music, Idle Chatter Jr. The urge to strike again was motivated by the hope that time, experience in better hardware and software would give Jr. advantages his siblings lacked, and consequently, a substantially different voice. Having more fun with the basic idea of turning incomprehensible speech into percussion music was also irresistible. I never listened to the words anyway. This is a clip from Paul Lansky's Idle Chatter Jr. So, those samples are pretty short, and Lansky has a lot of fun rhythmically. Another, more recent electronic music producer notorious for slicing and dicing, is BT. BT has gone so far as to create commercial software to manufacture his somewhat patented brand of stutter edits. Start by cutting up the samples into small pieces, and then repeat some of them, like a stutter.
UK, from a baby to a boy to a man today, and I'm a musical man, and I'm a man of birth, but I got a little problem and it's getting worse. My life was so well planned, surviving and jamming in a funk band, cause rapping it's my bread and butter, but it's hard to rap when you're born with a stutter. Well, no one's ever seen what I mean.
No, that was not BT. That was Morris Minor and the Majors doing the stutter rap, from the 80s. BT will cut the samples into ridiculously small pieces, and repeat them very, very close together. Short enough pieces glued together begin to sound like singing, or other guttural sounds. It is all rather groovy, as you will see with this next clip from BT. The track is called Somnambulist.
Too little joy, it's gonna be too little time, too little time, time to work it on out. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Too little joy, too little joy, it's complicated. I feel I'm stumbling in the dark.
Repetition of very short samples here is bordering on a technique known as granular synthesis. A very short sample of audio can be broken into thousands of short pieces of sound. When played backwards and forwards, and layered on top of each other, longer new sounds can be created. This short clip of a small child talking can be turned into a lengthy wash of sound.
You've been listening to Robin Davies, Further Excerpts from the Oral Machine, and that was episode 6. You've been listening to Be the Media here on CHLY 101.7 FM here in Nanaimo. And I just want to say many thanks to our guests today, CJ Your DJ, Ravindra Moabir, also to Robin Davies. I'm Marion Vanderzon. Thanks to Neil Scobie, and you've been listening to Be the Media on CHLY 101.7 FM. We'll be right back. Be the Media is brought to you by the Media Studies Department and the Media Research Lab at VIU.
How does that grab you?